Your Honors, my name is Tom Fisher, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Larry J. Simkow and Janice Cruz. Your Honors, before the court, raised a briefing three issues, that being notice, substantive fairness, class action, as well as attorney's fees. If I may, I'd like to begin my discussion by talking about notice. Your Honor, notice in this case to this class of vulnerable individuals was essentially abysmal.
If I understand the record, the notice was mailed to the claimants. It was published in two major newspapers, received extensive coverage on television, talk radio, and websites. Why wasn't that enough?
Your Honor, it wasn't enough for several reasons. If I could just begin with the court's last observation, the discussion in the media of the case is not necessarily dissemination to the class of the terms of the settlement. But I think more substantively on this point is, for example, 9,000 separate notices were returned to the government of Guam as undeliverable, and no further action was taken to remail or find a better address for these individuals. That was 9,000 out of a potential pool of 49,000. Additionally, Your Honor, there was no updating of any addresses in the case at all. And as a term of the settlement agreement, the parties actually agreed that as to class year 2004, well, as to tax returns, which had not yet been processed, though they were presumably sitting in a bag someplace on the floor of the Department of Revenue and Taxation, these particular returns, which had not yet been processed, the government simply wasn't going to do that to include them into the class because, as they said, it was, as I understand the argument, it was it would have caused a delay in the submission of class notice, and it was essentially too difficult. But the law and the Constitution in the matter is that if you can reasonably identify these people, individual notice is required. It's not something that is dictated by the phrase, I think, from Eisen, is the depth of the plaintiff or defendant's pocketbook. If you can reasonably identify, which one court is referred to as front-loading analysis, if they're identified, then they're entitled to individual notice.
Regardless of the cost of following up on these people, for instance, the INS, I mean the IRS, had all of these files. The cost of finding 9,000 people and a bunch of files would be justifiable?
Well, yes, it would, Your Honor. I think that goes to the practicability analysis.
Yes.
And it is practical to do so. The United States certainly does it. We certainly do it through regulations. They require reference to the United States Post Office's National Change of Address database. And it's simply something that is certainly available to the government of Guam, although I think in their briefing they argue that that particular regulation, and that regulation is not required. But, you know, this particular issue is not really a question of tax law. This is a question of constitutional due notice and the application of Rule 23. Is it practical to ask the post office to tell us whether or not these particular addresses have been updated? It certainly is. And again, just to reiterate, the United States says that every single year. And the requirements of the Constitution are that if you have, if an individual can be identified, first of all, if the individual can be identified, they get reasonable notice, and notice must be the best practical. The argument that, well, it's expensive.
Practical cost of a problem. It says the best practical. Is that supposed to be a problem for you?
No, sir, not in.
Because there's no doubt about it, individual notice would be the best, but there's a qualifier.
Best practical notice. Yes. So I think, yes, sir, the court's inquiry would be whether or not it would be practical to take an additional step. For example, in the Jones v. Flowers case, in that case it was standing merely for the proposition that you have to take an additional step when the government finds that their notice has gone awry, you got to take an additional step. If it's failed.
When we review, do we take a look at how many people did receive notice through the method that was used? Does that matter?
It certainly is part of the background. But
does it matter what percentage failed and what percentage was successful? Do we take that into consideration?
No, sir.
As we talk about practical.
No, sir. And the reason that the court
so if say that even if 90% of the people were notified through the methods used, 10% clearly were not, because of the return, bad address, whatever reason, you would say it's not practical because the requirement is everybody 100%.
Our response would be that it would be practical to do the address updating, but our primary response today, Your Honor, is that this particular percentage, how successful it was, which is the government's argument, is simply saying that that's good enough. And this is a class of people who have been told too many times that this is good enough. We on Guam are as entitled to the protection of the Constitution as any American citizen. And if notices are
I like your speech, but you wanna get right to what we're gonna have to decide, because we're gonna decide this case on the record before us, aren't we?
Yes, sir. You are.
All right. And what's the hope?
The record
what's the problem?
The record that you will find before you is that one, in the settlement, it was reasonable to identify a whole class, a whole subclass within this class of people. Yet the government decided not to look at the tax returns to find their address. On the record, this court will discover that 9,000 returns or notices came back undelivered, and the government took no additional step. On the record, this court will discover that the United States, Guam's a mirror system, the United States typically, and in many class actions, typically, notice procedure requires address updating. That's the Parker case. That district court said that if you don't do the notice updating in that case, then it probably doesn't need the C2. So on the record, I think that this court would be compelled to discover and rule that the notice provision in this case was just too far below.
Is the finding of practicality a factual finding so that we owe deference to the trial court?
Your review on this issue of the adequacy of notice is going to be de novo.
In Flowers, there was a gentleman who hadn't paid his taxes. The taxing authority knew he moved because they got the tax returns from the address. And it was one person. Here, what you're saying is the government should have looked at as to 9,000 people, keeping in mind the amount of money that they returned. Is there any indication in the record of how what it would cost the government to find the 9,000 address?
I don't think there is no indication that I'm aware of in the record of how much it would have cost, but then the courts also say that Rule 23 isn't tailored to the size of, I guess, in Eisen, that was plaintiff's pocketbook, and that involved a mailing of something like 2,000 or 2,500,000 different cases or different notices.
What I'm thinking of is the trial court in a position to say, well, given the cost of sending out 9,000 new notices after doing so many hours of data research to determine where each of them is now, or if he's dead, or if he's moved away to someplace else, the next best thing is publication of the papers and known by media. Isn't that determination the one that we give deference to?
Well, in this situation, all of those notice techniques went out together. It was all mailed together. The publishing took place, and then the 9,000 came back. And again, I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
So the question is, the district court judge takes a look at the 9,000 returns and says, it's probably going to take so many employees, so many hours to find each one of these persons and send out a second notice. As a practical matter, media notice in printing, newspaper ads, and announcement over the radio and television is a practical solution better than individual identification of new addresses.
Well, I think the court should take what it was the district court said on that and then to make a de novo review.
Why is that a factual finding for which we should give deference to the trial judge?
Well, I think we're coming back again to de novo review. You have in front of
you. You'd like to know review because it's constitutional right to all 9,000 get looked at. Okay. Get to your second point.
Okay. Well, I think I would also follow up by saying that that doesn't appear to be the government of Guam's argument. And whether or not the court made the determination that you're going to accept that, I don't call that in the record. But I think government of Guam's argument in this case is that they simply didn't have to do that because it wasn't required by tax law. And, or it wasn't required by their adoption of regulation. So if we assume it wasn't adopted by their particular regulation, I don't think that really answers the mail in this case because it's a constitutional question. And another aspect of this that
you want to get to your substantive fairness and your jury speech soon.
Yes.
You've only got 4 minutes.
Okay, I'm sorry, sir. Moving on to the substance of it. Substantively here, tax year 2000 was compromised. There was the classes were eventually broken in, or analytically, I suppose, they were separated into two groups. You had those who fell within the shadow of a potential time bar here because of 6511, and as Judge Martinez made an observation, 6532, and then you had cases which fell outside of the time bar. And what the settling parties did is they lumped 2000 into the potentially time-barred cases. Now, without getting too deeply into the weeds here, in 2000, you had to make your return by 2001, and then you've got a three-year clock run. So that stretches your possibility of filing an amended 1040, 1040X, out to 2004, past the time of the filing of the first action by Mike Phillips. And American Pipe, Scardelletti, cemented everybody in. It stopped the clock for everybody. Yet the party said, well, no, 2000 has to be put in potentially time-barred years because there's a 6532 clock running, and that is a two-year clock. Well, if 6532 actually ran, then the argument kind of makes sense. But here in the Ninth Circuit, this court, in the Ninth Circuit, the law is that you only start 6532. You only start 6532 if you get registered notice of disallowance, and that never happened in this case, so we think that's kind of a canard. There was no 6532 clock running. 2000 should not have been lumped in with time barred years, so they got compromised. And then the second part of the substantive unfairness that we brought up to the court is the fact that they said they leveraged interest. And when we talk about interest, we're not talking about pennies. This is not a coupon case, of course. This is EITC. We're talking thousands of dollars for individual claimants. And hundreds, at least hundreds, in dollars in interest. Well, all of that was waived. And the reason it was waived, the court observed, was because they were leveraging the interest in order to compensate potentially time-barred classes.
What do you mean leveraging?
Well, they were saying, we'll give up the interest if you mentioned it, you won't push back. Essentially, they were saying, we'll give up the interest if you don't push back on potentially time-barred years. She said they were leveraging the interest. Well, that means that the folks later in time who had no problem as a potential time bar, those folks had to give up all of their cash in order to make sure that the older folks got options.
So there was mistreatment on one group, the rest one group compromised in order to get some money to another.
Precisely, sir, and that's just not acceptable. You're not allowed to do that.
Can I get your attorney's fees?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Moving on to the attorney's fees, Your Honor. If you provide a benefit to the class, you work hard to provide a benefit to the class, you ought to get paid. And we provided a benefit to the class in our summary judgment holding in which we established the ability to settle this case. You could not have certified this class without SimPal. SimPal established the exhaustion of the administrative remedies. Without SimPal, the court wouldn't have had jurisdiction over this case. By SimPal establishing that we had exhausted the administrative remedies, it made it possible certify the class that was entirely uncompensated. We first defeated the motion to dismiss in this case. We were not compensated for this. What we are saying is that, I don't think there's an argument from the case law I've seen, is if you provide a benefit to the class, then you ought to be compensated for it. We worked hard for this class. We established the ability. We provided the atmosphere, the potting soil for this entire settlement. And we didn't get compensated for it. And we would like to get compensated for it. And we're asking this court, first of all, to do away with the settlement. It's substantively unfair. And the notice does not be constitutional or Rule 23.
One last question, counsel, because the time is up. Our scope of review on the attorney's fees question, do you agree that that is abuse of discretion?
It is abuse of discretion. That is my understanding. And I know that the case that Ms. Payne recently cited, I think it was the Fitzgerald, the previous case that submitted supplemental authority, they discuss in one of the headnotes there, attorney's fees, that was a recent case.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Dawn Payne, and I represent Appellee Governor Juan Felix Camacho. With me this morning is Mr. Rick Bordillo, who represents Commissioner Appellee Julie Santos. As this Court is well aware, the District Court is vested with broad discretion in settlement matters, particularly in a case like this one, where the negotiations were presided over by a respected and experienced settlement judge, and it is undisputed that the settlement here is the product of an arm's-length, non-collusive, negotiated resolution. Yet despite that fact, despite the District Court judge's broad discretion, and despite the strong judicial policy that favors settlement, that Judge Ferris noted in Pacific Enterprises security litigation, despite all that, objectors seek to unravel a $90 million settlement that has benefited tens and thousands of low-income workers on Guam.
On the issue of notice, what is your response to Mr. Fisher's point that letters came back undelivered. The government took no action whatsoever to find out further addresses and send them again. Why?
The law of the circuit is clear. Notice need not be The law of the circuit is clear. Notice need not be perfect. It need not be actual. And here it just needs to be.
Okay,
theory.
Best practical.
Right, and
let's not talk about theories. Give me facts. How much would it cost the government to have found out, tried to find out, second attempt, as it was in Flowers, second attempt to find out what the people would be? What would it cost? Is there any evidence on that?
There's no evidence. I'm not aware of the cost. But I just want to note that in Jones, the court there, actually the Supreme Court, found one of the arguments that the plaintiff made was, you know that notice came back to me, so you have a job to go through government records and find, or the phone book, and find my new address. And the court said, no, that's not a reasonable, practical step. And so there's no authority from the Supreme Court or
in the Flowers case. The holding was the Arkansas taxing authority has not given constitutionally sufficient notice.
Correct.
And the reason is because they got the return mail, this man no longer lived at the address where they sent the tax notes, and instead of trying to find out where he lived, he went ahead and auctioned off his name for taxes.
But I ask if you, there is actually a section in there which talks about what's required is additional practical steps. Mm-hmm. And the court did not say like what those steps need to be. And the steps are gonna vary according to the circumstances of each case.
That's why I get back to the question, what was impractical? Why was it impractical to find out from the data bank where these people now live?
Well, as we have in our supplemental record, there's the Department of Revenue and Tax is understaffed. They have tons of responsibilities. They're overworked, and they weren't able to go through and find all that. And this is the government of Guam. They aren't able to access their computer system doesn't link in to the United States postal system. They can't just go and get the data, and it would have been impractical. And then this judge found the notice here with this 9,000 people. She specifically found that it's not clear that even if that the notice was resent, that it would have reached more people.
What if 20,000 returns? instead of 9,000, it was 20,000. That would clearly be very difficult for the government, but wouldn't that indicate that close to half the class hadn't received notice? Would the government have no duty with respect to those people?
Perhaps, Your Honor, I'm not sure. I mean, that's a different, completely different circumstance, but I'm not sure. I mean, it would have depended how much it would have cost, the reasonableness, the practicality of it. And Judge Titan-Gatewood, the issue of notice, it is a de novo review, but her factual findings are entitled to deference.
You said there's nothing in the record about what it would have cost the government. It's just that would have been difficult. Let me ask you another question. Tim Powell's expert states, the settlement notice lacks a true headline, utilizes fine print and wall-to-wall words, is difficult to read and navigate, and incorporates confusing legalistic terms and words. Looking at it, it appears that they're quite correct about that. Do you contend that it's not a proper characterization of the notice? Was the notice clear, and what makes you say that it's clear?
The notice was sufficient. This is a tax case. It is complicated. There's going to be a lot more legalese in a notice dealing with tax matters than in one dealing with products liability. And I think that with notice, we have a room full of bright people. We could all work together and create what we think is the perfect notice that has, you know, a proper font, all these headings, and then someone else could come in here and tear apart the notice and say, no, I would add a heading there, I would add a heading there. So there's a range of reasonableness when it comes to notice, and I believe that this notice,
I can fill that. The notice with that suggested by the Federal Judicial Center, it's the difference in day and night. Big headlines, so that someone who is not sophisticated would say, well, I better look into that. The ordinary person looking at the government's notice, in my opinion, would just pay absolutely no attention to it at all. All the fine print, well, that's a legal notice. It doesn't pertain to me. Could the notice have been clearer, number one?
I think any notice could have been clearer. And yet, probably the notice here could have been clearer. But again, that's not the standard. It's not whether or not the notice could have been better.
Was it clear enough, and why was it clear enough?
It was clear enough. And I think the facts of the case bear out that it was clear enough, because about 90% of class year 2004 went and they filed the EITC claims. So clearly, it served its purpose to let people know that there was a benefit out there for them, and then they sought that benefit.
On review, what's the question before us today in your view?
The question before you today is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in granting a settlement that was fair.
You get into a little trouble when you talk about abuse of discretion and you're looking at it in over review, don't you?
Oh, sorry, there's the three issues before the court. The first being the fairness and reasonableness of the settlement. The second being the attorney's fees, and there's no dispute that those are abuse of discretion. And even with the notice, there is an issue of discretion that goes along with the notice for the judge's factual findings, and this court, in regard to Gibson, found that Rule 23 doesn't require any actual form of notice, any way to get the notice out, and that's left to the district court's discretion. So under the circuit's law, there is discretion, and I believe that Judge Titan-Gatewood understood that, and she took her role very seriously. It's clear from reading the opinion. It's a very thorough opinion. She was concerned about the class members. She was concerned about the attorney's fees, making sure that everyone had notice. And so I believe that that's the issue, is whether or not there was an abuse of discretion and whether the notice passed constitutional muster, which is de novo review. But as this court recently noted in the Espinoza case, that standard for whether notice passes constitutional muster is low. And here, this clearly did.
Would you make a comment on the request for attorney fees by Simpel's attorney?
Yes. Again, this is abuse of discretion. And Mr. Fisher does not show the district court abused its discretion in granting the attorney's fees. They claim that without them, there wouldn't be a settlement. But there's nowhere in the excerpt of records to support that fact. Their objectors are objectors. They aren't parties to this case. And under the law, they have to prove to the district court's satisfaction that they made a benefit to class. And so they presented their pitch to Judge Teddy Go-Gatewood. They listed all the different ways that they thought they benefited the class. And she identified each of those ways in her order. And she carefully considered each of those ways. And she rejected all but one. And her rejection of all but one wasn't an abuse of discretion. There was no clearly erroneous finding of fact, no clearly erroneous finding of law. What she did was she faithfully took her job as a fiduciary for the class in awarding attorney's fees. Thank you. I just want to briefly address the issue again of the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. And
is that taken care of in your brief?
It is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll take a brief recess at this time. Can you have some time for rebuttal?
No, he did not.
Thank you very much. This case will be marked for submission. We'll take a 10-minute recess at this time.
All rise. This court stands in recess for 10 minutes.